In one of the interview, you doubted about the appearance of an effective anti-coronavirus vaccine and mentioned AIDS as an example, which still couldn't be treated by a vaccine. Could you please explain why are you so skeptical concerning coronavirus vaccine and you don't believe it will appear anytime soon?
No, I'm not skeptical. I just say the opposite. We cannot count on having a vaccine effectively within the next half a year to a year, which is the common hope. I just remind that after billions of euros and dollars invested into HIV/AIDS research, scientific research, pharmaceutical research, and so on, we now have effective mitigating drugs against AIDS, but still, you know, millions of people die each year, and there's still to this very day no cure and no protection provided by vaccination with respect to HIV/AIDS. With respect to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, I just remind us that, you know, the SARS, the first SARS epidemic kind of withered away almost miraculously in, you know, 2002-2003. By June 2003, it was completely gone. But research started immediately, and we have now 17 years of research, and we did not succeed so far to develop monoclonal antibodies or any vaccination against any of the many coronaviruses. We know, you know, there are many coronaviruses which are pretty harmless and not dangerous, not as highly infectious as SARS-CoV-2. So as of today, after 17 years and after 40 years in the case of HIV/AIDS, we did not find any, you know, protection by vaccination. This is what I simply, you know, register, observe. I would hope, of course, very much that we are more successful, and there are good indications why we will be probably or possibly more successful the next time. But I, at the same time, let's take note of the fact that 17 years we have not been successful so far, and so to build a strategy exclusively on having a vaccination very soon seems to me very fragile and risky, a risky strategy.
So we should be afraid of the future in
We should not be afraid. We should be realistic. Let me give you an example. We should not count on an effective vaccination to be developed within what is now the common expectation between 6 months, 12 months, and 18 months at the grand maximum. Just to recall that despite the immense investment in scientific and pharmaceutical research, supported by billions of euros and dollars, we have effective mitigating drugs now, but still until this day, millions of people die each year from AIDS year in, year out. And there's no cure, no protection provided by vaccination. And even closer to the case, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the original SARS virus in 2002-2003, which withered away miraculously, so to speak, within half a year, turned out to be very dangerous, highly infectious, also high mortality, but hit relatively few people at this time. And ever since June 2003, this is 17 years now, it had turned out to be impossible to develop monoclonal antibodies or any vaccination against any of the many coronaviruses, many of them harmless. So I assume that, as with HIV/AIDS, we have only safe sex and hygiene in injecting drugs. We have only, as in 1918 with the Spanish flu, hand washing and keeping a physical distance remain as the only provable effective protective measures against the plague. this we should be aware. This does not mean that we could not, again, have very important scientific breakthroughs, but they cannot be easily predicted and we cannot count on them and cannot build all our strategy on this most positive and most optimistic outcome.
So should we prepare for mortality as we see concerning normal flu?
I hope not. Honestly, I hope not. Because the normal flu, we should not forget that the normal flu was killing hundreds of thousands of people each year. It's not just, don't speak of the Spanish flu in 1918, which killed more people than the whole First World War. But I'm also not speaking about the Hong Kong flu in 68 or the Asian flu in 97 or the swine flu in 2009, 2010. But I speak of the normal year in, year out flu, which kills up to 650,000 people each year. And we have become used to this, so to speak. And I gave the example that in Austria, where we do have vaccination available and it's pretty effective, up to 92% of the population, 92% of the population do not use a vaccination which is there, which is available, which can be bought at very low price. This includes even people like myself. You know, up to last year, I didn't take care enough of having a vaccination against something which is deadly very often. Thousands of people die each year, many more than died from COVID-19 so far. And we have a vaccination and people don't use the vaccination. So what I say is there are many factors which kind of complement each other, and the fact that to have a vaccination will not in the end always mean that the end of the fatal casualties.
In this case, I would like to move a bit another type of question and ask about future, but concerning our societies. Would coronavirus change society and governing in the future if we had this crisis, and maybe you see some changes are coming?
Well, it would be very surprising if it would not deeply change our society. And in some areas, we already saw things happening within weeks and days sometimes, which in the past decades didn't show any progress. I'll give you a few examples in the area of the world of work. You know, we have discussed telework ever since. We have been among the proponents of the promoting telework, promoting flexible working times, promoting digitalization and video conferencing, promoting trusted flexitime, the famous Vertrauensgleitzeit, promoting macroeconomic management. None of this really ever took off seriously. I'll give you a figure. Telework so far in the past was at the grand maximum 3% of the working population, of the workforce. Now within weeks, under the fashionable title of home office, this very same telework jumped to 30%, above 30%, and in some more advanced countries, like from the UK to Sweden, it jumped up to 50 or 60% of the workforce. I'll give you another example, just one. The video conferencing, instead of having business travel, excessive business travel, the Zoom conferencing, it's just one company, jumped up from 10 million to 300 million teleconferences a day by day. Now, whether this will return to pre-crisis figures, I don't think so. We will very soon see the real sustained level of digitalization after this sudden rise in mostly work-related exchange. But this will be a very good indicator which of this jump has become irreversible, a jump in professional communication, or how much of this step is just a short-term overshooting due to the crisis and will be followed by Zoom fatigue, by a home office fatigue, and everything will return to the status quo ante. If you ask me, I don't think at all. There will be many of this will become a permanent feature of the new world of work, but how much we will see rather sooner than later. So within my forecast is within the next half a year, we will see to what extent this has become irreversible, a learning process of the whole of society, and you know, the really lasting impact are things which have this so-called ratchet effects or pole effects, which cannot be undone any longer. Once, and you know, we have the debate everywhere now. We have the debate about the four-day work week. We have the debate about the flexi working time, that people do not have to register, you know, their time use any longer. This has been debated, again, for decades. Now, within weeks, it has been implemented, and it turned out that, in many cases, it actually worked. And it worked well, and it will not go away. Mm-hmm. And the same we could think of many, many other things, also threatening ones. You know, there are regressions in terms of our liberal democracy, which are also very worrying to me, because, you know, you saw how fast, how deeply, you know, deep in interventions in our civil liberties and liberal freedoms and everyday freedoms could be imposed in very, very short time. And, yes, in the name of health, in the name of public health, many things, this is a kind of secularist religion, you know, as the highest of all values. And in the name of health, many things could be done which otherwise could be done only in circumstances of absolute catastrophe, be it nuclear catastrophe or war catastrophe or whatever.
But I would like to stay a bit on a field of economy or society, because you said that yes, many changes came after coronavirus started and everyone were at home. But at the same time, what we see now is high unemployment rates, and not everyone could, in new circumstances, work. How will coronavirus change our economy in this situation?
Honestly, I don't know, and nobody who is a serious professional can predict this. We, you know, because everything will depend on our own action, and this is not predictable. There may be incredible learning potentials and chances for renewal, and there are also great risks of aberrations and regressive tendencies. We really don't know. Mass unemployment in itself may be one of the most dangerous long-term impacts of the corona crisis. And I think we have debated this already in the early 1990s, in reports for Conference of Ministers responsible for social affairs, that you know, unemployment itself has also incredible losses in social harm, in damage, in human losses, and it also loses lives. You know, we in our report of the Conference of Ministers responsible for social affairs, we brought up some studies where how many people die for each 1% more of unemployment rate in the United States. And this was about 21,000 at this time, 21,000 people dying directly by either because of heart attacks or by strokes or by suicides or by murder or by being victims of violent crimes and so on. And I did the exercise now of looking at the U.S. case again after 30 years. The corona crisis had the unemployment rate jumping up from 3.5% in February, so basically full employment situation, to 19.7% in April. This was the worst increase since the Great Depression after 1929. In April alone, 20.5 million jobs have been lost, and between February and mid-June, almost 46 million workplaces have been lost in the U.S. Now, if we, and the employment rate went, jumped up to 20%, twice as high as in the financial crash in 2008. But when I use the standards only of the 1970s, 1990s, the indirect non-coronavirus corona victims must have been, the estimates are very, very rough estimates, are in for the United States, 342,000 additional dead people through these secondary effects of corona, and about 2.3 million victims of crime, more than 500,000 people victims of violent crimes, just due to the corona crisis. I don't know, I didn't look up the figures, the daily figures about the U.S., but I think a couple of 100,000 people died. But it, so far, fewer people died from the virus than from the indirect effects of the virus through unemployment, crime, suicide, you know, all kinds of health risks which would otherwise not have occurred, like heart attacks, the strokes, and so on and so on. So I think, yes, this is one of the main risks we have to face, and it's very important to keep this on our radar.
You mentioned health a bit, but I would like to talk about it a bit more, and because we saw many restrictions emerge because of the health, because of trying to save lives. And is it really, should we expect something like that in the future in any cases? So the health is started to be some kind of sacred thing which we can give all our, many of our freedoms. And in that case, I would like to ask you if we are changing in this way as well, as societies as also. Hello? Hello?
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, now, yes.
Do you hear me?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, obviously I pressed my iPhone too close to my ear, so I will keep a certain distance. Okay. Uh-huh. No, you're right. This is a crucial thing. You know, the trade-off between the economic losses and the economic breakdown and the pandemic lockdown, due to the pandemic lockdown, and the health risks is really a very delicate matter. We should not forget that you know, those countries who did best during the health crisis, like Slovakia, for instance, when it comes to the economic prospects of minimizing the economic losses of the crisis, are not very good. Slovakia is an example. It's first in the health performance so far, but it's 22nd only when it comes to the economic prospects. The other way around, Denmark has been 20s when it comes to dead people. Sweden has been 27th out of 31 countries in Europe, so pretty much at the end when it comes to the death toll, but it is third best in the economic prospects. Poland is best in the economic prospects. Denmark second. All of them are very weak in the health sector. So maybe it could be there is a certain inverse relationship. This could be that there's a trade-off between success and failure in health and results in the economic crisis on the other hand. But what we have seen also, two things. One is that health, especially public health, has become a kind of secularized religion, a secularized substitute religion. There is no other value which is kept as high as health. This is, if you wish, so a neo-pagan, neu-heidnisch kind of value. But it has made and fused with, without much further ado, with the ancient Jewish and Christian sanctity of life, Lebensheiligkeit, the holiness of life. And if the holiness of life is set absolute, so then the avoidance of death, which would be avoidable, becomes a kind of crime, you know. And everybody who does not, prioritize everything against this, is an attacker on life. And I think this is a clash and the conflict of values over pagan as against Christian values, and how we justify certain actions. I think one step ahead would be to calculate the non-health damages, the non-health, not the life lost exclusively by the virus, but the lives lost by the way we manage to keep the virus, to cope with the virus, as well. Then we would have a much more balanced view and a much more complex, but at the same time fairer view, because obviously it favors different age groups. You know, if we focus on the losses in terms of health, it's obviously the elderly have to be taken care much more. If we focus on the second order victims, who are mostly younger, people who lose their income, who lose their jobs, who lose their skills, who lose property, who risk unemployment and poverty, who risk being victimized by crime or violence or alcohol and substance abuse, which grows tremendously during such a quarantine crisis, which are threatened by suicide, social neglect, by family disintegration, community disintegration, all those things which are not easily counted in terms of life and death, but which could be counted as well in terms of life and death. And if we kind of try to reach a balance, we would also be fairer towards generations, because I myself think that the framing of the coronavirus as a kind of old age plague, as the elderly, as a needy, high risk group for the protection of which, of the well-being of which, the whole society has to make the hardest sacrifices, is a very, very dangerous framing. And it will, now it's still tabooed, but it will create a wave of hostile and ageism and hostile, poisoned generational relations ahead, you know. Because never ever in the history of mankind, a plague has been framed by an age-specific impact on its victims, you know. Have you ever heard that people said HIV/AIDS is a youth pandemic? Or have you ever heard that the Spanish flu, which hit young people, not old people, or the swine flu, or the influenza virus, the California virus, the new flu of 2009-2010, all of them have shown significantly higher mortality with young people, whereas the elderly have demonstrated more immunization against these other influenza viral infections. But nobody has ever labeled it as a young people's flu. Now it's labeled as an old people's plague, and this is very dangerous because it will divide society. Corona will divide society more sharply than before. This is a terrible price we all have to pay, young and old people.
What we also see concerning that health started to be a religion, that non-democratic and democratic countries emerge the same type of restrictions. And so, you mentioned Lukashenko as well in this case. What I would like to ask you if we can see something, some different types of fighting coronavirus in democratic and non-democratic countries, or because we see also Russia, which military parade honoring the Second World War during the coronavirus crisis and voting for constitutional changes also in the middle of epidemia. So we see that this, but at the same time, Russia as well emerged new restrictions, and Belarus not, but in some cases started. I would like to ask you about if you see any differences, or maybe even not so much differences in this coronavirus, during this coronavirus crisis in Europe. How countries changed as well. I mean, Eastern countries and Western countries, maybe Middle Europa countries. How they do you see any changes in this trying? How they try to fight the coronavirus?
Yes, of course, there are enormous differences. Actually, given the fact that, of course, any kind of pandemic management requires restrictions, that's for sure. And in any society, liberal democracies, the rule needs legitimacy. Any kind of restrictions on freedom need consensus and persuasion, instead of coercion and violence. And then, of course, you see already that some countries, and I mentioned, the Philippines of Duterte, I mentioned South Africa, Uganda, I mentioned the idiocies of Bolsonaro in Brazil, or Trump in the U.S., or Lukashenko, we have violent excesses, and Mr. Duterte prompted his military and his police to shoot and kill if somebody makes troubles. I cite literally, if somebody makes troubles, he's shot. So which means that it shows on the one hand that under pandemic regimes already today, it goes as far as that you abrogate the universally holy prohibition of killing. You can kill in the name of war against the virus, in the Philippines, for instance. So yes, this makes a difference to other authoritarian inclinations, or just stupid, there are stupidities, the Bolsonaro and Trump style, this is just stupidities, but you find other authoritarian leanings from Turkey to Russia to, so many countries included, and this is what we observe. When we look at Europe, for instance, I'm not surprised by the authoritarian leanings in countries like Poland or Hungary, kind of who are self-declared illiberal democracies. But I was kind of shocked when I saw that even in a so-called social liberal country like France, within 1 month after the confinement, they had 15.5 million police controls carried out, and almost the millions of warning sanctions, notification, police notifications. This means that each day in France, in these 1 month of confinement, first month of confinement, you had almost 500,000 of police interventions, and there we should not be surprised that repeated riots of young people were deported, massive use of incendiary devices, and clashes with the police. So the impression is that not so much the war against the virus, which France was not very successful in, but rather the government and the executive had a war against its own population, where the population was affected not by the pandemic so much, but by the epidemic violence of the Gilets Jaunes movement. You know, this is a kind of Pujadist or proto-fascist inspired violent revolt. And this has contaminated the entire political community with force and infected war and chronic war games and so on, so that France had a pretty violent month in this. And the same we had in other countries, from Italy to Belgium, many of the countries who did very, very badly in managing the crisis. And the worst performance was from Belgium, but also Italy, France, and so on were not very successful in this. They obviously they have been leaning most towards authoritarian temptations, but the same also applies for Israel. In Israel, when you were more than 10 minutes away from bomb or 100 meters from your house, you already, you know, had a police fine to pay, and you know, contact persons were located by GPS, and the domestic secret service kind of even presumably infected people were continuously monitored electronically, and so on and so on. So yes, we had temptations and simple actions of police, overshooting police interventions and so on, everywhere throughout Europe. You had to pay 500 euros for eating a croissant in a park bench in Brussels, for instance, you know. Or there's thousands of examples. And in Italy itself, in the first 2 weeks of the quarantine, more than 100,000 criminal proceedings have been started in 2 weeks only against the population, and all the sudden things which have been punished by 3 months of imprisonment in the past, you were all of a sudden threatened by up to 5 years imprisonment in jail after the corona crisis. So yes, this has, you know, the danger and the threats have been everywhere, but still the differences between, you know, the Philippines and between Brazil and Europe, of course, are very, very important.
You describe many examples of what happened, but do you see the possibilities for change, even knowing all that happened? Maybe you're observing that countries started slowly reacting before pandemic, and maybe in the future we could see that it's going to be better?
This I hope very much. So, you know, we have been unprepared. You know, there have been, in Asia, they have been well prepared through the SARS crisis in 2002-2003. Miraculously, it ended in June 2003. And ever since, Asian countries have been preparing for that. Europe has not very much prepared. When the Chinese finally reported the last day in 2019 to the WHO, to the World Health Organization, of this new virus, it took the European governments 8 to 10 weeks, because before they started to really take precautionary arrangements, it took them 8 to 10 weeks, incredible 8 to 10 weeks, without any precautionary arrangements. And this could have saved us all lockdown. We could have done without any lockdown if we would have prepared, used the time, the critical time between late December and mid-March. Taiwan, for instance, has done so very successfully. The very same day, 31st of December, they have started 124 well-prepared preventive measures the same day, and they managed to keep the plague in check without any shutdown, as did many other Asian tiger states. I've been visiting professor in Seoul, in the Seoul National University, in November, and I followed this very, very closely, and they have been pretty successful. In Europe and the U.S., in marked contrast, we had a fiasco. You know, there's excessive demand, incompetence. First, they have been sleeping, hibernation, and denying it. Then they had a shock-induced paralysis, and only finally they slipped into a kind of panic over the pandemic with more or less successful strategies. And some countries have done very well in reacting forcefully and rapidly from the very beginning and not flip-flopping. You know, some countries have been moving forth and back, you know, Switzerland and Belgium and the United Kingdom and Sweden, also the US and Brazil. They couldn't decide whether they would rather expect an uncertain rapid herd, what they call herd immunization, whereas other countries have, you know, this hammer and dime strategy to hammer down the plague as quickly and vigorously as possible instead of the flip-flop responses. And this turned out to be have been a very good strategic choice, and some countries have been lucky to do this strategic choice. Others have been very, very tragically involved and hit by this virus months before it was officially recognized. And Italy is the most tragic example. The Italian corona tragedy really is a tragedy. And it's a mixture of very bad luck and also some mismanagement. But the mismanagement in Italy was not more of a mismanagement than in most other European countries, except that they were more lucky to be hit much later and much softer and, you know, much differently than by the viral invasion than Italy. So again, we see the whole complexity of different situations across Europe.
But at the same time, you said that the European Union didn't fail during the coronavirus crisis. Why do you think so? That on the higher level, it was not so slowly reaction, and the crisis was managed properly.
Okay, the European Union, of course, started out with terrible mistakes and uncoordinated wildcat border closings and these very shameful export bans on protective equipment. You know, this generated actions and scenes which Angela Merkel, for instance, herself later on confessed as having been shameful. And this is, one shouldn't. Deny this. But it's a widespread cliche and a very, very widespread popular prejudice, and also many experts, rigor, say that the unions once more completely failed. And I think this complete failure of the union is not even half the truth, you know, because, we should not forget that a continental response to this global pandemic challenge was not possible because Article 6 of the treaty, you know, says that the European Union plays an assisting role only in public health issues, and therefore it's completely dependent on the wisdom and goodwill of its member states. So, in purely structural terms, it's constrained by the lack of jurisdiction, and the Commission cannot do more than it did. But given this basic restriction we have, which is, in my view, be regretted, we should have, of course, all European strategy, well orchestrated. But given this starting position, the Commission actually did behave and act much better than its reputation. I give you several examples. You know, in mid-January, when even the Robert Koch Institute and some other very high-ranking expert institutions did not assume an imminent outbreak of the epidemic, you know, they said, no, this will not hit Europe very hard. The Commission already started and published it and updated it constantly, a risk evaluation, before the Robert Koch Institute. In late January, it activated its civil protection mechanism to repatriate EU citizens, again, many weeks before the member states started to fly back their citizens from abroad, from other continents, from other countries, back to their home countries, long before the member states. It developed guidelines for laboratory tests and warned about human-to-human viral transmission long even before the WHO. And again, it started procurement action for protective equipment, ventilators, intensive care units, and so on and so on. All of the things which were lacking, where the European countries could not agree to join forces to do this together, and later on had to import billions of respiratory masks of very mixed quality from China, millions of protective clothing from China, infrared temperature instruments, thermal imaging cameras, and so on, ventilators, you name them, tons of things from China, because they could not in due time, 8 to 10 weeks before, agree on taking the offer of the Commission to jointly procure very important medical commodities, which they couldn't produce, which haven't produced in Europe. So I think when we have a hard and cold and honest look of what happened, yes, there were things which shouldn't repeat themselves, you know, the border closings in particular, and the export bans, which were a shame. But at the same time, in many areas, the Commission acted actually better than the single nation states. So it's a mixed assessment, in my view.
And my last question is, are there any positive changes also which gave us coronavirus crisis? Maybe our attitude of to life changed, maybe something else?
As I said, there will be a long... If you do some brainstorming, we will be surprised how many positive, I call them collateral benefits. There are lots of collateral benefits which we can expect. Long term, short term, irreversible ones, temporary ones. So we just have to sit together and think about what these collateral benefits in what areas could we mention some of them in the area of economic life and how the workforce conditions will change. It's the very same we would find in every other area, whether it's ecological innovation, whether it's the skill structure, whether it's the digitalization advances to be expected. So all together, I'm pretty optimistic that the learning potential of this crisis will be a very, very significant one. More than we will learn more from this crisis than we have learned from other, you know, in other periods. Altogether, I'm optimistic that the crisis offers significantly more opportunities than it will have to confront us with painful damages and losses and harms, which are undeniable. But altogether, I think it may be it offers the chance of new of great learning potential.
Yeah.